You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, welcome to Blogging Heads TV. You're watching Culturally Determined, and I'm your host, Arye Cohen-Wade. And my guest today is Chris Arnotti. Chris, could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi, I'm Chris Arnotti. I'm a photographer, a writer at this point. I have a PhD in physics that I parlayed into a 20-year career on Wall Street. And I guess at this point, 5 years ago, I quit Wall Street to focus on photography and writing, and focused on primarily addiction and poverty, which has subsequently grown into writing about, I guess, despair. And that's who I am.
Yeah, so I first... you first came to my attention via Twitter, where you are semi-prolific, and you write some very interesting Twitter essays, and which also link to your longer writing. We'll include links to your Twitter page and your writings for The Guardian and your very beautiful photographs. So first, you laid it out briefly, but could you talk a little bit more about your background and how you came to Wall Street, what you did there, and why you ended up leaving Wall Street?
Yeah, I guess my evolution is one of kind of being always a math geek to kind of being somebody who feels like that kind of rational, numbers-based approach to life is a bit lacking. In the steps in the process was I got a PhD in physics. I was theoretical physics, so from Johns Hopkins. I specialized in quarks, leptons, those sort of things, very fundamental forces. I got my degree in 1993, and it wasn't a good time to be getting a degree in particle physics for a variety of reasons, but I wasn't particularly good at it either. I wasn't going to be a successful particle physicist. And I also just didn't like it as much as I thought I would. And so I wanted to be in a field that was a little bit more more based in reality and more immediate. And so I ended up on Wall Street, and how I got there was something somewhat accidental, but looking back at it, it followed the arc of kind of a lot of neoliberals at the time, of thinking that markets were not as bad as we had thought, and kind of, you know, the Larry Summers, Robert Rubin wing of things. And so I got to Wall Street, I guess, right about the time Clinton was elected. Mm-hmm. And kind of whole real, you know, and I was a Democrat, and I was on Wall Street. I was a bond trader, like Liar's Poker is probably the best. I did go to Solomon Brothers. I was a bond trader on Wall Street. So I had a quantitative bent. So I guess some people call it a rocket scientist. So, I mean, I haven't seen the movie Big Short, but apparently people who have seen it said it kind of reflective of what I did. Mm-hmm. On Wall Street. So that was that evolution. The next step, kind of leaving Wall Street, was a little more, to be glib, I would say I try to regain my soul. But when I started on Wall Street, if you had asked me when I started on Wall Street, I would have told you that what I was doing wasn't bad, but it wasn't good either. It was benign. And by the time I left Wall Street, I was convinced that what I was doing in Wall Street, what others had been doing in Wall Street, was bad. And so I had kind of fallen out of favor with Wall Street. And the financial crisis was probably what I call the anvil that broke the camel's back. It was kind of the sense that that whole way of looking at the world, that whole philosophy was wrong, and I wanted to look at things in a very different way, and that meant interacting with people at a very personal level. And so I went to the Bronx. I went to the poorest neighborhood in the Bronx, and I ended up spending 3.5 years documenting and becoming friends with a group of homeless addicts, heroin addicts, that became the focus of my life.
Could you talk a little bit about how you're on Wall Street working on Wall Street for 20 years, how the culture there changed from 1993 to after the financial crisis when you left?
Yeah, it went from being a, you know, I came in at the very end of an era of partnerships, kind of small firms run by people who had their money invested in the firms. I mean, and then by the time I ended it, they were big public companies. The companies I joined had just recently gone public. Solomon had recently gone public, but it was a very different in mentality. It was there was a lot of bullshit and craziness going on Wall Street when I joined, but people were somewhat self-regulating because it was your money, right? Everybody in the firm, basically, especially the people, the higher ups, had to have their wealth reinvested in the firm. So there wasn't the sense of like, hey, let's just, if we blow up the firm, you know, the government will bail us out. Well, no, if we blew up the firm, we lost our own money. So there was a sense of, you know, some fiduciary responsibility both to the firm and to the clients. And in addition, you know, the Wall Street was a party of Republicans, and the Democrats were opposed to Wall Street. But my coming onto Wall Street as a Democrat I wasn't an isolated event. There were others doing it. And Clinton administration in particular brought in a new approach of Democrats towards Wall Street. So by the time I left, or by the time while I was there, what had been an opposition to Wall Street party was now one that was pro Wall Street. So without any regulatory oversight from either party, Wall Street kind of spun out of control. And, you know, by 2000, we just doing crazy things with nobody really, with both political parties on our side. And in addition, that private partnerships had fallen apart, and there was no responsibility coming internally or no regulatory body from external. And so the whole Wall Street just kind of was like, you know, speeding out of control with nobody watching it. It was just a disaster waiting to happen. And the disaster happened. And when the disaster happened, you know, we bailed ourselves out. And it was just a really, you know, when the disaster happened, I kind of said to myself, because I was at the center of it, I mean, you know, sitting right there, I said to myself, well, we fucked up really badly. You know, let's rethink everything. And I expected other people to say the same thing. You know, it was like, suffer a little bit of humiliation and rethink our whole worldview. But everybody around me actually doubled down on their worldview and said, well, we didn't fuck up. You know, we were too regulated, or, you know, just the lack of kind of self-awareness really was a body blow to me. I really kind of made me rethink everything I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's just kind of the standard psychology of people think they're usually doing the right thing, you know, most of the time, or is it something about the way Wall Street was set up or the kind of people who end up there led to that lack of reassessment?
I think, you know, I would have said the latter up until this recent events with Trump, where I think there's a lot of people who are in denial about what Trump represents. A lot of people fucked up in this election. You know, I the same sort of like sense of like, okay, we fucked up. Let's look at ourselves and see how we were responsible for it hasn't happened. And instead what's happened on Wall Street is people say the blame game. Well, I didn't fuck up. It was somebody else's fault. And so, you know, that sort of, to connect the two, I think people, when they are in a, you know, when you're in a situation and you're in control of something and it blows up, there's never any, I don't think anybody is going to take responsibility. I think it's always the, hey, it's not me, it's something else, or a doubling down. I think it's rare for people who are in power to ever be self-reflective or humble. And I think the lack of humility on Wall Street, the hubris that went with what I saw, but it was a hubris that wasn't just confined. It was a hubris that came with that whole worldview of rationality and data, you know, that the whole looking, you know, hey, well, look, the numbers say this, or, you know, that sort of worldview I believed that sort of heavy framework of mathematical approach without getting involved with people. that sort of framework failed. And it's also a framework that encourages a belief that you know what you're doing, a kind of hubris. And that's kind of why I went to the Bronx to kind of, you know, to recheck the way I thought and to basically listen to people and to listen to people who have a very, very different experience from what I had.
Mm-hmm. So the phrase that just popped into my head while you were talking about that was Masters of the Universe, which is from Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities. And you mentioned The Big Short and Liar's Poker, which are both books by Michael Lewis. The latter is an entertaining movie that came out a couple years ago. Are there any other works that you think of popular culture or art that kind of capture what was happening on Wall Street during this period?
Bonfire, you just mentioned it. Bonfire of the Vanities is perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's one of those books that, you know, a really, really solid parody is one that's kind of on the cusp where you don't know if it's parody or not, you know, it's just like, you know, that one standard deviation above and you're like, is Bonfire of the Vanities clearly extreme? Yeah, but it's not that extreme.
Right.
You know? There is that sense of really owning people really think they know everything.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I recommend Bonfire of the Vanities I think it was made into a movie that is notoriously bad that I've never seen, but
it's an atrocious movie, doesn't it? Just please don't watch it.
But the book is great. It's very entertaining and it's like 550 pages, but still relevant, you know, 30 years later. So you left Wall Street and started your current work with photography and journalism. And the thing that I think it's in your Twitter profile has you've kind of been known for is this metaphor about the front row kids versus the back row kids. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that was something that came to you relatively late. But so I was doing this project in the Bronx for three and a half years, and I kind of saw this. I kind of restructured the entire way I looked at the world. And I decided to go on the road and see if what I saw in the Bronx was the same elsewhere across the United States. And so I put up 175,000 miles on my car just driving around the country. And I went to a lot of different communities that were kind of overlooked, whatever phrase you want to use that is kind of derogatory, kind of left behind. In all these communities, I was going to places that kind of where drugs were entering, I saw this in Wall Street when I was doing the Bronx series too, because there was this period where I was working in Wall Street and then going into crack houses at night in the Bronx. So it was this kind of weird universe I inhabited. But what I kind of saw on when I was driving across the United States, 175,000 miles on many, 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 many trips, was I just saw this country that was immensely divided. We talk about the usual divisions about race, class, gender, and all those are very relevant. And I would say the biggest division in the country still is race. Mm-hmm. I mean, even now, we're just one of the most segregated. It's just it's remarkable how segregated we are, including, you know, New York City. But what I saw was I could go into a town, and I could tell you immediately within 5 minutes in the town that the town had a university, if it was an educational center. Or if I went into a large town, I could tell you when I was close to a college campus. And so I started realizing to me that the biggest division I saw in our country was beyond race was education. Mm-hmm. You know, there was kind of what I would call I started calling them the front row kids after the school metaphor, and I only use the phrase because it kind of took off on Twitter when I used it once. People resonated with it, but it was, you know, it was the people who, like myself, who kind of always excelled at school, who used their education to move out of the town they were born into, went to an elite school, and generally had a postgraduate degree. But and then there were what I call the back row kids who, and again, I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I mean that in a way of anybody who doesn't have an elite education or generally is only a high school graduate or less. But, you know, what I started realizing, it wasn't just this division, you know, between the front row, what I call the front row kids and the back row kids, wasn't just about, you know, how much money you made or it was really a division in how we viewed our worldview, what anthropologists, I guess, would call a worldview or an ethos, where the front row kids kind of inhabited this world where meaning came from rationality, where meaning came from intellectual pursuits. You know, we rank each other by, you know, who can make the you know, who can come up with the cleverest arguments, or who gets the highest scores on exams. That's our hierarchy. And we move for our careers. And our meaning, our sense of world comes from our careers, and our careers are based around intellectual pursuits. And we don't really have a geographical base. We just move wherever. You know, if a job takes you to X, you go to X. And that's where that imbues us with our ethos and our worldview. And then there's the back row kids who, their worldview comes from what the sociologist Michel Lamont calls the decency of hard work. You know, their hierarchy is kind of the idea of like, well, I may not like make a lot of money, but I work hard. I spend a lot of time in truck stops because I spend so much time on my car. And, you know, I spend a lot of time around truckers, and like the way they think about themselves, they're really proud of how many miles they've driven without having an accident, uh-huh. Like, you know, 2 million miles, 3 million miles. That's kind of their worldview. And in addition, you know, they're much more focused on faith. They're less focused on rational arguments, and their community, their meaning comes from the local, literally the local. The geography from where they are, it comes from their networks of family connections. It comes from their churches. It comes from their, you know, they're born into a place and they often stay there. Now, this isn't to say there isn't, you know, I always say your lived experience may be different than my ethnographic types. You know, that's a broad, in a mathematical model, we call that the toy model. That's the most salient features I saw in the country.
Mm-hmm. And how has this played out politically, particularly in the last election?
I mean, if I was in a what I call a back row community that's white, they voted for Trump. And if I was in a front row community that was white, they voted for Clinton. And I would say that, you know, there are plenty of African Americans and minorities in the back row, and they're assigned there often by birth, by our structural racism in this country. You know, and I've spent more time on my trips to working class minority communities like Gary, Indiana, like East Buffalo, like you know, Central Cleveland, like Selma, Alabama, and these places, a lot of the frustrations of the back row, was politically rent. How it got, I always say that if you're in the back row, you have a lot of despair, a lot of frustrations, and how that gets rendered is a function of race and place. Mm-hmm. The white front, if you're a back row kid in the white, if you're white in the back row, you can vote for Trump because you can overlook his ugly policies ugly racial policies that demonize minorities. If you're black in the back or minority in the back row, you can't overlook that. And so a lot of the frustration was rendered as basically lower turnout, a resignation of not engaging in the political process, which you see in the statistics as well. And that is not to say that you know, the GOP hasn't taken advantage of that and made it harder to vote, but in both cases, there's a sense of despair in the back row, independent of race or place.
As someone who spends time on Twitter, you probably saw this joke that became a running joke among the liberal commentariat about economic anxiety and racism. Did you?
Yeah, it's offensive as fucking hell, man.
Right. So for people who don't spend time on Twitter, you know, there's the phrase economic anxiety came to be a running gag in that you could take a group of white people and say they're voting for Trump because of economic anxiety, but really you mean racism. So the meme would be finding some instance of someone flying the Confederate flag or something like that, and then say, well, this must be economic anxiety. I mean, how do you think, if there's the racial divide that you laid out, where disadvantaged minority voters are staying with the Democrats and disadvantaged white voters are going Republican, how much does racism itself play into the political divide that you see?
I mean, the GOP has been playing the racist card for a long time, so it plays a fair size. But I just want to, before we address that, I want to address the economic anxiety meme for a second. You know, one of the big frustrations, look, I'm a progressive. I've voted for Bernie. I've subsequently voted for Hillary. I've voted for Democrats all my life. One of the things we Democrats, progressives, hopefully do is give context to issues. So when people demonize minority communities and say, well, look at the rates of crime or look at the rates of poverty, and they say, well, blacks are, you know, violent or blacks are lazy. When the conservatives do that and say, you know, we progressives rightly say, well, no, that's atrocious way to look at things. Let's look at the context. Look at the structural racism. Let's look at the unequal opportunities provided to communities. Let's look at the lack of education. Let's look at the lack of jobs. Let's look at the police force, which treats the neighborhoods as places to be occupied, not places to be policed. What we do is we look at it and say, let's give it context, and let's not go. So I could go into, you know, if a conservative went into a housing project and found a overweight black woman who's out of work and who, you know, has three kids or four kids, and said, oh, economic anxiety, you know, next to her picture, I think we progressives would be outraged, and rightfully so. It's stereotyping at a level that is offensive. And it's intentionally duplicitous as well. It's just obnoxious. I spend my time as a photographer and writer going into communities. One of the things you have to do is choose not to find the worst example of each group to try to demonize a group. Uh-huh. I could do that in any group I went to. I can go into a Trump rally and find the person with the Confederate flags and pick them out and highlight them. I could go into a Bernie rally and find the vegan clueless, who doesn't know what a bank is, who says Marxism lives in their parents' basement. You know, there's all sorts of tropes you can drag out. And I think to do that online, when you have a large platform is offensive as hell. But going back to what you said, look, are there racists who support Trump? Yeah. but are there lots of other people who support Trump? Sure as hell are. You know, one of the things that I encountered, I went over the last eight months, I went to counties that I call OOT counties, places that have voted Obama, Trump. And I met many white people who voted for Obama twice and then voted for Trump. I mean, I guess they're racist. I mean, but they voted for Obama twice. Uh-huh. I mean, and look, the phrase I prefer is that captures the larger percentage of Trump voters is having white privilege in the sense that it allows you to overlook certain issues, right? So. Look, I voted for Hillary and I voted for Obama. When I voted for them, I didn't want to vote for their Yemen policy. I didn't want to vote for drone strikes in Yemen because I don't happen to be Yemeni. I can overlook that policy that I don't like. Can whites overlook Trump's, ugly language about and dog whistle and less than dog whistle? Well, yeah, they can, and focus on his issues of saying jobs, 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 jobs. Can an African-American or a Mexican do that? No, they can't. They have less of the ability to do so. But, I've met a lot of African-Americans. I met a less than, I met, you know, African-Americans, working class African-Americans who voted for Trump or who didn't mind him. In fact, in the working class black communities I went to, I found less anger towards Trump than I found on college campuses.
Mm-hmm.
I'll send you the picture. I'll send you the guy to go talk to in Rochester. You're in Rochester.
Yep.
And the McDonald's there, I met three guys, African-Americans, who voted for Trump. You know, he wears a straw cowboy hat. You can go talk to him.
I that's an interesting phenomenon for sure that, you know, Trump, you know, who a lot of people on the left saw as this blatant racist, did attract enough minorities. And if Clinton had won the, you know, gotten the percentages among the minority communities that Obama did, she would be president now instead of Trump. Let's note the white privilege and see if we can come back to that later in the conversation. I want to ask you, do you think Bernie Sanders would have won against Trump?
Yes, but take that with a grain of salt because I voted for Bernie Sanders. But having said that, one of the things that I encountered, and I can send you pictures of the people, and I did a little tweet storm of it, is, you know, in the most traditional Trump places, most cartoonish Trump places, Prestonburg, Kentucky, I just got back yesterday from Portsmouth, Ohio, Scioto County is another one that swung from very heavily to Trump. So Scioto County is in Ohio, right on the Ohio-Kentucky border. I would go to a McDonald's table or I'd go to somewhere and there'd be all these older white guys who, you know, drive up with their American flag trucks and just their usual. And here I am expecting to hear Trump, 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 Trump. And yeah, I'd hear that from 3 out of 5. And then 2 of them go, yeah, but I like Bernie. And it was just kind of, you know, I met a very memorable number of what would be lampooned as kind of Appalachian white redneck who were very pro Bernie. And almost, you know, in aggregate, even those who didn't like him would always say, yeah, but he was honest. I was, you know, when I told people I voted for Hillary, I would always tell people, you know, the standard line would be, well, I'll pray for you.
Bless your heart.
When I told people I voted for Bernie, there wasn't that. There was like, yeah, you know, he's, you know, I get it. So I think he would have won. He would have had the turnout problem in the minority communities. But I don't think you would have seen the big swings in the white working class that you saw. You saw less of a swing. How's that?
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's policy based or is that character based?
Both. I mean, they get mixed together. I mean, look, one of the things we tend to forget, I don't throw you in that category because I don't know if you do, but what people on Twitter, political writers, tend to forget is that what obsesses us that particular day, it doesn't reach to most people. Mm-hmm. People are just too busy to focus on politics. They get the grand scheme. They get the grand sense of things. They get the kind of just, you know, the vibes. And I even notice it when I'm out, you know, spending 2 weeks and wherever I'm spending 2 weeks and I miss out on stuff. I just don't, not that important. And, you know, the grand themes that came out of Trump in a positive sense were jobs, jobs, jobs. He connected to people who've been saying, you know, these back row communities I go to where black and white that have been suffering for so long on a downward trajectory. He came in and said, he's the only person who didn't come in and scold them and say, well, just move or your careers are outdated or it's not NAFTA. I mean, you know, no, you don't have it that bad. You know, iPods are cheaper now. You should like what you have. He just came in and said, no, it sucks here and we're going to try to fix it. Now, I don't believe he has any ability. I don't believe he intended to fix it. But, you know, he's a sham artist, and the sham artist sells people what they want to hear. And what people wanted to hear was, if it sucks here, fix it. you know, and the status quo is broken and you guys don't care about us. And here's somebody who claims he cares about us. And Bernie did that too. Mm-hmm. And Hillary, Hillary Clinton, yeah, I mean, it didn't seem genuine. She came in and said, well, I'm sorry about your plants falling. Here is 97 policies that will address that. You know, oh, and here's a smorgasbord of green jobs and LGBTQs and blah, 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 blah. Oh, just come in and say jobs, 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 and then say, oh, and by the way, we're for equality for everybody, mm-hmm. which we should be. That's a great thing. But, you know, jobs, 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 jobs.
Yeah, so one of the best kind of pieces on politics that I've ever read and really informed my thinking about politics was written by Chris Hayes before he was a famous TV person. When he was just at The Nation, he wrote this piece about he went door to door knocking for Kerry in 2004, and he wrote about undecided voters and how they view politics. And the metaphor he used was that these people follow politics the way you might follow a sport that you don't care about at all, where you're kind of like, oh, it's a Super Bowl. Who's playing?
That's exactly right.
Is it New England again? And yeah, so the stuff that obsesses political journalists and the commentariat, the day-to-day, you know, the average person does not watch cable news. They're too busy. They have other shit to do with their lives. And I mean, Trump, I've long believed that he's a con artist, and I think he probably pulled off maybe the greatest con in world history by being elected president. But he does know how to capture people's attention and get people to buy what he's selling, at least for some length of time, before he goes on to the next con. But he can't really do that anymore.
I think what he's been selling all his life is cheap meaning to people who are desperate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, cheap products, right?
Cheap ties, cheap steaks.
I mean, he knows how to do it.
Do you think the people who are with Trump are going to stay with him if in 4 years, if Trump stays on the... I mean, he's had like a disastrous, you know, 9-10 weeks. If it keeps going this way, are these people going to see through him, or are they with him?
I think he's already, you know, he's already revealing himself to be not what he said he was going to be. And I think the healthcare debacle was a huge thing. You know, I was in this town, Cairo. It's called Cairo, but it's spelled Cairo, but they pronounce it Cairo.
Right. My wife is from rural Illinois, so I know some of the unusual, you know, New Madrid, Illinois, yes. Places like that.
Cairo is a fascinating place, in not a good way. It's where the Mississippi and Ohio meet at very southern Illinois. It's a small town, about 3,000, 90% African-American at this point, that's been depopulated, has lost everything. It's one of the most depressing places I've ever been in terms of just like literally 2/3 of the houses are boarded up and gone. But where the Ohio and Mississippi meet, there's a little park there that nobody was at except for one gentleman, or three people, a white gentleman and African-American couple who was his friends. They were out there smoking dope. They offered me a hit, and I chose not to have one. But he voted for Trump. And we talked, and he said, well, I no longer like Trump. And I said, why? He goes, well, he showed me a scar. We had just recently had brain surgery. He had a tumor removed from his brain in January, and he was a carpenter, and he said, look, I didn't have health care, and Illinois, whatever their Medicaid, Illinois Cares or something like that, paid for me. And he says, and this was happening while Trump was announcing his, you know, Ryan bill, and he knew enough to know that was bad. it was that sports team playing in the political bowl was not working for him. Uh-huh. And he said, oh, I wouldn't vote for Trump at this point. And, you know, healthcare is visceral, especially in the working class. And because, you know, you get beat up a lot when you work manufacturing jobs. in the back row communities, healthcare is extraordinarily important. And Trump has really blew it with that one. And I think, you know, the kind of mask is off in the sense that what he's, all those wonderful words he said, you know, the scam artist can't deliver. And it's going to take him delivering, you know. I mean, look, if 4 years from now there are more jobs in these communities and there's more hope, he has a chance. And if they run Hillary, reboot the Democrats, you know, yeah, he has a chance. You know, and if the Democrats continue to behave little temper tantrums like they've been behaving, there's always a chance. But I doubt it. I mean, if the election were held today, Trump would not win. Hillary would win the Electoral College. You know, I think she might not win Ohio, but she'll win Michigan and Pennsylvania at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the how Trump has played the healthcare stuff really surprised me, because if Trump wasn't like an idiot, he could put together like a middle of the road policy, and, you know, if he just says screw the deficit and we'll deliver healthcare for everyone, and he keeps his immigration and trade policies, but kind of runs like a conservative in Europe or Canada, you could see him assembling a coalition that actually works. But it, I don't know, it was shocking to me that he actually embraced the Ryan bill. He just doesn't seem to understand this stuff. And it seems like he got played by Ryan, and he really isn't that smart. And he just does whatever, you know, the last person he talked to tells him to do. So it's
yeah, he doesn't care. And that was, he doesn't care. He doesn't care. He just wanted to get elected. I mean, I don't even think he wanted to get elected. I mean, I think it was kind of the dog catching the car. Right. I think, he enjoyed the campaigning. He was good at it. I think there's parts of him that really believed, you know, the jobs thing. And I think there's really parts of him that really did connect with some of these communities. I'd give him that. I'll give him that he really did buy into it, but he's way, way, way in over his head. And it's unfortunate, you know, because it's going to really hurt the communities that voted for him. More, you know, it's going to hurt the communities that voted for him. It's going to hurt the minority back row more, you know, but the entire back row is going to be hurt, with the minority back row being hurt the most. And it's really sad.
Something I read just a couple days ago online, I can't remember where, but it made the case that the main divide now in America isn't left, right. It's libertarian versus authoritarian. And Trump represents the authoritarian side of that, whereas coastal liberals represent libertarianism, but, you know, there's also traditional libertarianism. Do you see that kind of desire for not a strong man exactly, but just like a strong leader who's going to get things done? Do you see that as being part of Trump's appeal?
I look at it slightly differently. I think it's kind of I look at it like, look, the back row community, I call them the back row, whatever, the overlook communities, the non-coastal elites, whatever you want to call them. And it's not just coastal elites, by the way. There's elites in Chicago. There's elites in Cincinnati. There's elites.
Even in Rochester, New York, there are elites.
Yes, you can go to the University of Rochester. A few neighborhoods away, there's elites. But what I would say is I will say it's the educated versus the uneducated in that sense. The two different worldviews, and one is very global and the other isn't very global. And I think if you look at the path of the back row communities, the kind of people who put their meaning in faith and put their meaning in community and put their meaning and in white privilege, that's been on a decline for the last 30 years. They've been devalued. And I think it's their way of saying, okay, I keep losing. You know, if I vote for Jeb, I'm just going to keep on losing. If I vote for, you know, Hillary, I'm going to lose. If I've lost in every with everybody in the last 30, 40 years. So I'm just going to knock over the checkerboards. I'm done. It's like game over. I quit. I'll do anything to stop this path. We're wrecking. I'm seeing my lifestyle devalued. I'm seeing my sense of meaning devalued. I just want to try anything else. Mm-hmm. So I think in that sense, it's just game over strategy. Let's just throw sand up in the air and just hope something better comes out of it. Wasn't working for me. How it happened to fall around, authoritarian versus global. I'd say globalism versus, I think globalism on the one side is certainly close, at least versus kind of more localism. Mm-hmm. Is the way I look at it.
If the Democrats want to try to win back some of these voters, the people you're talking about, what policies should they pursue, or what should their concrete policies be, and how should they also change how they talk about their policies?
I'm really not a very good policy person, and that's just not my area of interest. So it's not where I put a lot of focus. But I would say that putting the working class first, in the sense of revaluing unions, removing ourselves from Wall Street. You can't put up a candidate who got $300,000 for speaking to Wall Street for 15 minutes. Uh-huh. You can't. Look, I worked in Wall Street, as we talked about, and Hillary Clinton, the Clintons did more for Wall Street than almost any politicians. I don't mean that as a, that's not, that isn't a, that, I'm not just trying to troll people. I mean that seriously. The Democrat, and I've written articles about that. Clinton's been very, very good to Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And that's the end. You can't be the party of Wall Street. You can't even be tinged with being the party. You have to be the party that's against Wall Street. You have to be the party that's for the working class. So that means, I just saw a really sad tweet storm today from James Fallow, who I guess is some, Atlantic.
The Atlantic.
Who's been doing an admirable job of driving. Where I'm driving around the country, he's going to overlook community. He's flying his personal plane to these communities.
Right.
Not surprisingly, our articles are very different. It's like he goes into the communities and finds the best things, the nonprofits that are working to build robots for minority kids. And I go to places where people are dealing drugs. So we have a very different view on things. But he wrote a tweet storm today basically saying we should accept our – we should, some billionaire gave $100 million to some like that. He said that's really a great move, that we need to see more of that. Billionaire is giving back. if that's your solution, that the billionaires are going to start funding nonprofits, no, that's sad. You have to break up the monopolies. Matt Stoller has been writing these great pieces about how the Democratic Party caved into, got rid of its anti-monopolistic policies. You have to really just, we can't be free trade is a solution for everything. I think you got to be a lot more thoughtful about, free trade and the benefits and the losses. We have to emphasize getting jobs into communities. And we have to de-emphasize the importance of a handful of elite education, the status that comes from an elite education. We have to start funding free college for, you used to be able to walk out of high school into a factory. You could do that in Rochester once in a while. You can't do that anymore.
Home of Kodak and also Xerox and Bausch & Lomb were also founded in Rochester.
You can't do that anymore. And you need to have a college degree to get a job. And people know that. And so we need to make college degrees we made a high school education necessary and free because it was required to get a job. We need to make a college education certainly free.
But can the people you describe as the back row kids, could they hack it in, a state school branch if they got free tuition there, or are their skills just not?
So we're getting to the part of the conversation that's where I just throw up my hands and say, I don't know the solution, to be honest. That isn't sound like some sort of kumbaya where we just have to value everybody. You know, I mean, look, at our core, we've built what I say is the biggest problem in this country is we believe we're a meritocracy, and the actuality is we're not. We say, look, you know, we rank by education, but that everybody can just pull themselves up. But, you know, if anybody just wants to get an education, they can just do it. They can't. People come from wildly different backgrounds, especially minorities, in terms of having access to education, having access to getting a good education, having access to getting an elite education. Not everybody can do it. Not everybody has the skill set. Not everybody is built in a situation that you know, the family allows them to. They have obligations to family. They have obligations to place. They're born into situations that are dysfunctional. And getting an education staying into school and staying at the front of school is a Herculean task, given how they're tasked with adult problems at an early age, social and family problems. And I think we have to just be more cogent of the fact that not everybody has the same. We're not a meritocracy, and we have to basically consequently stop rewarding the winners from our quote system as highly as we reward them, and stop punishing the people who fail in our system as highly as we punish them. So what policies do that? You know, taxing the rich more. decriminalizing. Drugs to the extent we treat them as a public health issue, not as a criminal act. But you know, more than that, it's not just about things like that. It's about the stigma we assign to people the social stigma we assign to people who don't share our values, our educated values. And there's no way you can change that, you know, without. I don't know. There's no policies implemented to say stop scorning the uneducated.
That's a good transition to something that I saw on Twitter within the past week or two, which is about McDonald's. So someone either hacked into or a rogue McDonald's social media employee tweeted out something that was against Trump, and it was quickly deleted, and it obviously wasn't intended. But the writer Josh Barrow,
the ultimate front row kid.
Josh, we can talk about him a little bit more. He tweeted, "This is a quote. This is a real brand misstep for McDonald's. Fat slobs with bad taste are a core Trump demographic." And you had an interesting response. So can you talk about? We don't have to talk about that much, but can you talk about the role McDonald's plays in some of these communities?
Yeah, you know, I use McDonald's as kind of a metaphor for a lot, and because it's something we all know. I say, look, our divisions are not just about economic. They're not just economic. They're about they're cultural and social. And to be honest, the front row kids define what is cool, and kind of academic speak, they control valid cultural capital. They're the cool kids. They set the agenda. They decide, you know what. And in more sociological, anthropological terms, they define what is sacred and what is profane. Mm-hmm. And I always use McDonald's as an example. I always say that, I come from a very small town. And we got our McDonald's, or the town next to us got our McDonald's in 1978, 79. And I was a kid then. I was, I guess, 15. And that was a big deal, man. That was exciting. That was like cool. And then, you know, I come back to New York and I did my thing on Wall Street. And then I started spending time with addicts and the homeless. And I was spending, when you spend time with addicts and the homeless, you spend a lot of time at McDonald's because it's got free Wi-Fi. It's got electrical power cords to charge your phones. It's got bathrooms you can shoot up drugs in. It's got a policy that generally lets people just hang out. It's got cheap food. And I ended up on my travels spending a lot of time in McDonald's, and I started realizing, wow, man, these are like you know, in a lot of smaller communities, McDonald's are basically community centers, and they really are. You know, I started seeing people, church groups, having Bible studies in them. I saw bingo games, dominoes games, and then every McDonald's I go into, it doesn't matter where I go, there's always a morning coffee group that can be from like 5 to 20 people, and the African American community in the black section of town in Milwaukee, there's also some guys who bring a boombox and DJ a blues like 3-hour blues show. It's like really, it's good. You know, it's like they're really places people hang out and do things in, and they're kind of essential in a lot of small communities. And so I wrote this piece calling, you know, McDonald's or ad hoc community centers. And I started, you know, the way we view McDonald's is very much revealing in my mind. You know, so I jokingly say on Twitter, just to get a rise out of people, that a lot of people like Josh Barrow would rather eat bespoke insects, you know, curated by like a Nigerian chef, you know, who had been profiled in, you know, Gourmet magazine, than eat at McDonald's, you know. And then, of course, he tweeted that, which just played right into my hands. You know, so within the front row communities, within the elites, McDonald's are profane. They're beneath them. Now, I'm not saying in the back row communities they're sacred. They're far from it. Although I've seen church groups there, you know, so they're but they're not profane. And that division there is a good example of how we just see things very differently, and how we the front row kids, the educated elite, come with a lot of privilege we don't realize, because, you know, and how we use that privilege to basically look down on people who don't share our values and cast scorn on them. You know, the way when you're in the front row, there was this other meme going through liberal circles, progressive circles, as well as, look, the front row is also GOP. Jeb is just as front row as Hillary, if not more. There's this all, you know, I worked in Wall Street with a lot of libertarian Republicans who are very much the front row, where you look down on people in Appalachia, you look down on the white working class, you look down on the black working class as having profane values. You know, they eat at McDonald's. How that's, you know, that's disgusting. And it really, the way you look at them is to basically say they're dumb, or they're beneath you. Or they're fat slobs. Was that the phrase he used?
Yep, fat slobs with bad taste. And we should say he apologized for this tweet.
Yeah, I mean,
after he caught a lot of shit for it.
Yeah, like, you know, he enjoys doing that shit. You know, that's why he gets attention.
Well, let's talk about privilege for a little bit. I in a previous episode of this show, which we'll link to, I interviewed.
Wait, what's the show?
Culturally Determined. On blogging.
I didn't hear what you said. I physically didn't hear what you said.
Oh, a previous episode of the show, I interviewed Phoebe Maltz-Bovey, who wrote a book about kind of the privilege wars. So you used the term white privilege in this conversation. Her book is about how she thinks this whole argument is kind of a wrong turn for progressives. How do you see white privilege playing out in the, what does it mean to you, and how do you see it playing out in these communities?
You know, I think it's very much a book. I remember being in a trailer park in Wise County, Virginia, with a guy who'd been in and out of jail, white guy, working class guy, been out of jail for meth dealing and all that. He didn't have anything. He grew up in that. He grew up in a situation that was very dysfunctional. His dad was in jail. His mom, you know, gave him to her grandma at 3. That sort of, you know. And he just looked at me and said, you know, look what all my white privilege has gotten me. You know, looked around and just kind of like, nothing, man.
So did he use that term unprompted, or did you ask him about it?
I think I said something about, you know, like Trump being a racist, you know, what do you think about Trump being a racist? And he was like, no, I don't think Trump's a racist. And I said, well, I mean, a lot of people said that, that there's being white can come with a lot of privilege. And he's like, yeah, you know, look at all the fucking privilege has gotten me. Uh-huh. You know, I think, when the white working class and people like him judge themselves, do they think they have privilege? No. Do they have privilege relative to black working class? Hell, they have a lot of privilege, but that's not who they're comparing themselves to. They're comparing themselves to, you know, someone in New York City who says, oh, you have privilege, you know, like Josh Barrow, who says, oh, look at you, you've got all this privilege. Not relative to you, I don't, you know. So I think, you know, it's hard to see that privilege when you're hanging by a thread and everything feels like it's going to cut that thread. You know, I think, again, do they have privilege relative to the black working class? Yes, they do. Do they have privilege relative to, you know, a professor of Greek history at Cornell? No, they don't.
Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I got a little Skype error. Why don't we close out with?
Is that fair?
Yeah. Well, I guess I would say a lot of the way the privilege discourse has played out, I think, is not positive. I think privilege or racial advantage definitely exists. You'd have to be kind of a fool or a racist yourself to deny it. But yeah, the guy, you know, the guy in the trailer park is not advantaged that much. And harping on racial advantage the way a lot of progressive young activists want to, I think, is just a way to divide the people who are on the left and alienate people instead of, you know, working towards some kind of solidarity among people of different groups.
You said better than I did.
So let's finish out by talking a little bit about drugs. That's what kind of got you started with this project. And I think the more and more you hear it being talked about, that there's a growing opioid addiction epidemic in the country. How do you see any solution to this? Do you see that this is inevitably going to keep on rising? This is maybe a depressing way to end the conversation, but can you just talk a little bit about what you observed?
I'm in the minority in the addiction community. Addiction is a demand-driven issue. It's not about supply. I'll use a sociological term, anomie, wherever there's a sense of feeling meaninglessness or lack of integration or pain, or people turn to drugs to try to deal with despair. I don't think how it gets rendered is a function of supply. So I think what's going on right now is not about the pill factories. It's not about, you know, the overprescription of pain medication. It's about the fact that a lot of people are feeling a lot of despair across the country, a sense of meaninglessness in a lot of places, a sense of being left behind. And I don't see that ending. I was just in Portsmouth, Ohio, and I spent 3.5 years in the Bronx, and I don't think I've seen, and I spent a lot of time in East, really places, minority communities long devastated by drugs. And I haven't seen that sort of drugs causing destruction community in a white community like I saw in Portsmouth. I mean, it's just, and Portsmouth is ahead of the curve in a bad way. I don't see us. To be blunt, no, I don't see it ending anytime soon, because I think will policy address the harm reduction issue? Yeah, which is great, fantastic. You know, we'll get treatment. We'll deal with, keep diminishing the pain that comes from the use of drugs. But now we're getting into cycles of kind of intergenerational problems. Like, I met a 19-year-old in Portsmouth, a white woman, who, you know, was born in, her mom introduced her to the drug at 13. So we're getting into that stage of the crisis where it's becoming intergenerational, and you're getting all the concurrent social problems that come from additional drug use. You're getting broken families, you're getting kids born into dysfunctional problems, you're getting other kids trying drugs because it's cool, and it's getting locked into place, as it were, and that just is a bad trend, and I don't see it ending. So I'm sorry to be depressing.
I've one final question is, do you think that direct government employment could be a solution for some of these communities?
To what?
A kind of like a civilian conservation corps type, like basically the government employing people directly to give them things to do, not make work exactly, but a massive public works project that could employ men and women somehow. Do you think if somehow, and you can almost imagine Trump embracing that kind of thing because he's a megalomaniac, although it seems very unlikely. Do you think something like that would help more than just giving people like a welfare check because it encourages work?
Absolutely nobody I've met, black, white, Hispanic, wants a welfare check. They want a job. They'll accept a welfare check, but they'd much rather have a job. And of course, there's always, you can point me to one example. You know, there's in every community, there's bad people, lazy people, but in aggregate, amongst the working class, amongst whatever group you're in, I've never met a group of people who say, yeah, I'd rather have a handout than a job. Everybody wants to feel the meaning that comes from a job and the pride that comes from a job. I'd say it very simply that people want to feel a valued member of a group, of a larger group that values them. Mm-hmm. So there's different forms you can have. They want to feel a member of a church that gives them meaning, that values them. They want to feel a member of a factory or a union that gives them meaning, or they want to feel a member of a political movement that values them. You know, people want to feel a valued member of something larger than themselves, mm-hmm. that then values them. How you do that is less clear to me. So jobs with a kind of strong union is probably the classic liberal answer to that. I will say that even whatever smallest town I go into, anybody who's affiliated with a college, even if it's a community college, in that community is in a much better shape than people who aren't. Educational institutions really help a town. So I think if your goal is to kind of, you know, revive a town, I would do everything I could to bring in a college. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be a big college, you know? So when I saw that someone gave like $500 million to Harvard, which already had, I don't know, $20 billion, you know, if that $500 million went, if a million went to 500 different smaller community colleges across the country, or 5 million went to, you know, you know, 100. I think that would do a hell of a lot more for the country, because where you really find the vibrancy, even in the smallest towns, is in the colleges. I was just in Shawnee State, I guess, in Portsmouth. And even there, whenever I go to a community, I go to the community college in town. And talk to the students. And those are the ones who give me real hope. You know, they're kids who don't come from a lot, but are really trying to better themselves. And, you know, to value those forms of education and to put more money into those institutions, I think is really the way to go. Mm-hmm. to help these communities, to provide everybody with a sense of, to stop overvaluing the Ivies and start revaluing the state's smaller state schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly a more optimistic note. So why don't we end there?
All right.
Chris, thanks so much for your time. We'll link to your Twitter page and your Flickr and your work with The Guardian. And thanks also to our viewers and listeners. They can subscribe to this show on iTunes or anywhere else they get their podcast just by searching for Culturally Determined. So thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.